We are talking to a friend, a fellow reporter, Lou Raguse, who is an investigative reporter with Care 11 Television, and he has written a book. It is so cool. It's called Vanished in Vermilion, and he is on our John Schuster Coldwell Banker Hotline. Lou, thanks for coming on.
Thanks for having me, Susie.
So if you hear an echo, it could be, did you hear that echo? You don't have your radio on, do you?
No, I don't.
Okay, well, just never mind. I'll just not listen to it. So tell us the story. You were a young reporter. It was a summer. Tell us about the incident in Vermilion, South Dakota, first of all, and how you came to the story.
So back in 1971, two high school juniors, Pam Jackson and Sherry Miller, were on their way to an end-of-the-year drinking party out in the country outside of Vermilion, South Dakota. And these were not your typical party girls. They're kind of branching out, trying something new. It was Memorial Day weekend. They kept getting lost on the way to this party. They ended up running into some classmates, some boys from their class, who were surprised to see them on the way out there. And they asked for directions how to get there, and they tried following the boys there. They never made it to the party, and they were never seen again.
And what happened next? So it was a cold case. They never found anyone. And how did you come to it? Oh, go ahead.
So the investigation at the beginning was kind of pathetic on the local sheriff, who insisted that they ran away. And the case kind of eventually disappeared, except for, of course, the families and friends who wondered all those years what happened to them. Fast forward to 2004, and the state of South Dakota opened a cold case unit, and they picked this case as the first case that they wanted to solve with this cold case unit because they had a suspect in mind who was a prison inmate who was in prison for a rape and had a terrible history with women. And he happened to be living in the area where this party was held back in 1971 and would have been about the same age as the girls at that time. So they reopened the case as a cold case in 2004 with the thought that this guy killed them when he was 16 years old himself and potentially buried the girls and their car on this farm he was living on. So they dug up that farm, trying to find the girls, and really that's where I came into play because I was a reporter in South Dakota at the time.
Okay. So that's where you come into the story. And so you covered it as it became a reopened case, obviously.
Yes. And they pursued it as a murder case. And then that's when, I'm not going to give away the spoiler, but there's all sorts of twists and turns that this cold case takes. And ultimately, several years later, we find out what happened to Pam and Sherry, and it's a big shocker. And the reason that I wrote the book, though, is that the authorities never explained all these discrepancies over the years, all these things that they got wrong. And we're talking about things like using a hypnotist to hypnotize witnesses to try to draw out 30-year memories and then believing everything that they say.
Oh, my goodness. So you started this. When did you first get your hands on this story? When did you first see this story?
Well, I kept in contact with the families after I moved out of South Dakota in 2008. And about the time that I moved back to Minnesota, back to the Midwest, which was 2015, around that time I started talking with the families again, and they were interested in having me put something together for them at first because there are so many wrong details in all the coverage of it over the years in the press that they really didn't even know what was true and what was not. And the case had always intrigued me so much, and I wanted to do more digging into it. And so I told them, you know, if you're willing to give me the time to really research this for a book, I would rather do it that way. And, you know, in that way, put it out to the world for everyone. And that's what they wanted me to do. And then that's what I did.
How hard was it?
It was extremely difficult because, you know, in Minnesota, when a case is closed, you can just request, do a data or a FOIA request for all the police documents and interviews and videos and so forth. In South Dakota, they don't have a data practices law.
Oh.
So they can keep police reports closed forever.
Man.
And so I lobbied and pushed until finally the attorney general in South Dakota granted me access to the full case. And then the local sheriff the current sheriff and the current police chief in Vermilion also gave me access to their files after that. So I kind of had this unprecedented access to a case in South Dakota. And so as the people are reading the book there, their minds are being blown because they didn't know any of the stuff that was going on in their own backyard.
My goodness. So was it a lot of material? I mean, you talk about getting access to different places.
Yeah, like 7 banker boxes worth of documents.
And you read them all line by line?
Yes.
So I don't want to give away the book. The book is called Vanished in Vermilion. Do you get answers? I mean, do you feel at the end of the book satisfied?
Yeah. So in 2013, 2014, it came out in the news what had happened to Pam and Sherry. But there really weren't like the answers. And so not only do you find out what happened to them, but you find out all the details of how it got to that point. And so that's the best way to put it, is that the finale, like the people who live in Vermilion, I tell them you might know how it ended already, but you have no idea how it happened.
Ah.
And that's what this book does for them.
Yes, because I know you were asked, why did you focus on the investigation and not just explain how it was all resolved? You had a sense about what you wanted to share in this book.
Yeah, it's all about the journey. There's 3 parts in the book. The first part is the initial investigation in 1971 and how it got screwed up so bad back then, as well as, you know, getting to know Pam and Sherry and who they were, even within their own families. Their siblings had such a wide age difference that their siblings didn't know them as well as like their classmates did. So that was an interesting part of it. The middle part of the book, the second part, is all about the cold case investigation, which is really like kind of 101 on how not to do a cold case investigation. But it's extremely fascinating, and a lot of stuff involving confirmation bias, where all of a sudden every clue that comes to the police looks like it points them in the right direction, but it may or may not be. And in the third part of the book is kind of like my own investigation after the fact in explaining how things ended up the way they were.
So Lou Ragu is with us. He is a reporter with CARE 11, and he's also an investigative reporter. You know, we cover in our life a lot of bizarre things, and we see different things. How did you know, like, and do you have other stories you say to yourself, you know what, I'm going to start taking, you know, this one's going to lead me down this path? How did you decide this book, and then why might you do other books?
Well, the weird part about this one was, back when I was covering the cold case, I would have breakfast with Pam Jackson's brother-in-law, and he would share with me all these crazy details that they were finding out from the cold case investigators. And he would tell me, someday you have to write a book about this, because the stuff that they're finding is so insane. But then so much of it turned out, ironically, not to be correct. But then the truth of what really happened ended up being a much more interesting book in the end. So it was kind of ironic that I turned back to this case after all of that. But it really took the resolution in 2013 to find out what happened to them to really raise a whole bunch of more questions that had just never been answered. By the time that it was revealed what happened to Pam and Sherry, most of the reporters that were covering the story were not there when the cold case was going on, because it's a smaller market where reporters come and go, stay a few years and move on. So it really was kind of like unfinished business from my mind. But locally here, you know, there's been a lot of interesting cases as well. But one difference is, you know, like I had the full support of the family in this one, mm-hmm. to pursue the truth. And that's really what's needed a lot of times in these cases. Like, you remember, of course, the Jamie Kloss kidnapping in Barron, Wisconsin.
Yes.
But, you know, that's, at this point, that's kind of Jamie's story. So, like, there's a lot of examples like that where it would take the people who are involved to really want it to be done.
Right, right. And exactly. And to have them be willing and brave enough to do so, because it's so traumatic. I mean, to try to have Jamie Kloss at that young age, and use her as an example of, to really mm-hmm. go deep and relive what was unbelievable and horrible, you know, I can mm-hmm. see that some stories just can't be told.
Yeah, and she may or may not decide to do that at some point. But in this case in particular, after Pam Jackson's sister read the book, she told me that it gave her more closure than the law enforcement authorities or even the memorial service that they eventually had gave her. So that was, you know, like a really meaningful compliment that you can get from a family member that makes it feel like it was worth doing.
I was going to ask, you were asked by the paper about this. Why weren't you initially more skeptical of the authorities and what they were telling you? Because I know as news people, we do get press releases and we do go with whatever we are given. And in this case, obviously, so many mistakes were made and misinformation.
Mm-hmm.
Does it sort of change how you see your own job and when you get information from people and how to look at it?
Yeah, and there were a couple of different reasons for that. I was only 22 years old at the time, so, you know, I was learning how to do the business on one hand. But the main factor was that in South Dakota, you just have no way to double-check their work. And so they were giving us what we thought was a lot of information. And like, I'll just give you an example. When they searched that farm, they have a search warrant to search this farm, and then they file the receipt or the inventory of what they took from the farm. And it said that they took bones and clothing and a red purse, among other things. And so, like, you know, well, geez, they took bones. You know, and we're like, we ask, are those human bones? And then their answer is, well, we won't know for several weeks until the testing comes back. And then, you know, we just report that and report what we're being told. Well, then they never end up telling us what the test results were, and we have no other way to check. It's because it's just a very closed to the public system there. And so we were victimized by the authorities in that way. And, you know, It's a lot easier in hindsight to say, well, yeah, they were lying to us the whole time, but, you know, we were just kind of stuck on the same token.
Have you felt that way in other stories that you've covered where you get, you know, stonewalled?
Yeah, I mean, we've been stonewalled before, but it was never to that extent. And I think that it helps in Minnesota that, you know, they can lie, but the lie will eventually come out. Usually nowadays anyway.
Yeah.
And so I think that keeps them honest a little bit more.
Yeah.
And there was no recourse there. And like, just as an example, one of the leaders of the cold case unit, went on to be the secretary of public safety for the state of South Dakota. So like basically everyone got a promotion when it was all said and done. The attorney general became a judge. The other cold case guy became the leader of the DCI, which is like the Minnesota BCA. So it's like everybody got a promotion, even though they screwed up. So nothing mattered.
Gosh, it just kind of kills you sometimes. Like, we live our lives and we sort of believe what we are told. And yet it's, I always think, honestly, Lou, of the George Floyd press release, the morning after Memorial Day, when, you know, a man in his 40s died of a medical condition. That's what it said. I don't know if you remember that, but, you know,
totally.
I mean, had there not been video, I think I asked that of the chief at the time, had there not been video, nobody would have even blinked at that story. A man
right.
in his 40s.
And even if an eyewitness came forward, you know, then you're like, well, do we believe this person that says that they saw different, or do we believe what the police are saying? Yeah. So it creates that's a problem. And
yeah.
So it is easier now to get to the truth, I think, than it was before. But especially when there were no ramifications, it was even harder.
Yeah. So two things. You're going to a book signing in your hometown. Is that right?
Yep. That's tomorrow.
And where is that?
Wheaton, Minnesota.
Wonderful.
And Wheaton, Minnesota. It's on the western border of the state.
And how do you feel? Do you feel pretty good? I mean, it's done, you're getting accolades, you're getting publicity. How does it feel?
Yeah, it feels great. I mean, it's like, you know, when you work on something for so long and you read it over yourself and make so many changes, then you start to wonder, oh, geez, is this thing any good? Because you've just only been looking at it yourself for so long.
Yeah.
So it feels really good to have other people read it and say how good they feel it is, too. And it's been wildly successful. Amazon sold out.
Within
6 days.
That's great.
And then had to get more stock right when we were promoting it. So That was a twist. But and Barnes & Noble's have been having trouble keeping it in stock as well. So it's been selling like crazy.
Is it kind of like a murder mystery? I mean, is it a page turner kind of thing? Is that how?
Yeah.
Because I love
absolutely.
That stuff. Yeah, I'll get the book. Mm-hmm. I'll read it.
And that's another issue with this case was, you know, the suspect, he had some legitimately horrible crimes. Okay, so it's not like, you know, Joe Blow on the street is just picked up and they're trying to pin something on him. It's like he believably could have done what they are trying to pin on him.
Right.
And so at that point, you know, it makes it harder to doubt as well. And
right.
And then also from the public standpoint, they might shrug and say, well, so what if they got it wrong? That guy's in prison and he did a horrible thing. I think the book really makes you question, like, what are your feelings on justice? Like, what does justice look like to somebody who may have done horrible things in the past, but is maybe not guilty of what he's being accused of now?
Yeah.
And it's a lot of gray area and self-reflection. And that's kind of what I thrive in the job, is kind of all the gray areas of all these issues we cover.
Yeah. Well, thank you. Drive careful tomorrow. We got some snow, so don't go fast.
Yep.
And congratulations on the book, and we look forward to reading it.
I appreciate that.
All right. Have a good night.
Good night.
That is Lou Ragusa from Channel 11. Brand new book getting great reviews, Vanished in Vermilion, the story of the summer of 1971. Two girls went missing. And have to read the book to find out more about what happened and the mistakes that were made.